From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this Thanksgiving edition, interviews with Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash. Their lives are dramatized in the new film Walk the Line.
We got married in a fever, hotter than a pepper sprout. We've been talking about Jackson ever since the fire went out. I'm going to Jackson. I'm gonna mess around. Yeah, I'm going to Jackson. Look out, Jackson Town.
We'll go on down to Jackson. Go ahead and wreck your hell. Go play your hand, you big talk man, make a big fool.
Interviews from our archive with Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this Thanksgiving, we're going to listen back to interviews with Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash. Their lives are being dramatized by Joaquin Phoenix and Reese Witherspoon in the new film Walk the Line. Here's how Cash and Carter sounded in 1965, about 3 years after she joined his touring show.
Let's get the best June Carter back out to help us with a song here. June,
come here.
Hey, let's get the Statler Brothers, too. Come here. Come here, June.
Let's get the
June, come here. Yes. Come here, I want you to sing a song with me.
I would be real quick to grabbing and clutching
okay.
on me.
Right. Huh?
I'd be pleased to sing if you'll just quit grabbing and clutching. I know it's the meanest man that's ever lived. Don't get close to him, girl. Since the show's over, run for home hard as you can go.
Sure.
Get out as fast as you can. He's wearing a new aftershave lotion called Come and Get It. Come here. See there? It don't bother me none. I got me on a new perfume called I Wouldn't Know What to Do With It. I forgot.
Come here.
From my window, leave at your own chosen speed. I'm not the one you want me. I'm not the one you need. You say you're looking for someone who's never weak, but always strong, to protect you and defend you, whether you are right or wrong. Someone to open each and every door, but it ain't me, babe.
Cash and Carter got married in 1968, about 3 years after this performance. He died in 2003, 4 months after she did. We'll start today's program with our interview with Johnny Cash, recorded in 1997, following the publication of his autobiography, Cash. He apologized to me for sounding a little under the weather, and a few days later he canceled his tour, explaining he had an illness with symptoms similar to Parkinson's disease. It was later diagnosed as autonomic neuropathy, a degenerative complication of diabetes that attacks the nerves and muscles that control the body's involuntary movements. Johnny Cash became famous with his 1956 hit, I Walk the Line, and went on to have such hits as Folsom Prison Blues and Ring of Fire. In the 90s, a generation of listeners too young to remember his hits from the 50s and 60s discovered him through the CDs he made with producer Rick Rubin. Rubin will talk about Cash on tomorrow's Fresh Air. Here's one of the Cash records Rubin produced.
Why me, Lord? What have I ever done to deserve even one of the blessings I've known? Why me, Lord? What did I ever do that was worth love from you and the kindness you've shown? Lord, help me, Jesus. I've wasted it, so help me, Jesus. I know what I am.
Your career has in many ways been about both the sacred and the profane. You've always been Christian, have always sung hymns. And on the other hand, there were times in your life when, as you write in your book, when you'd been in and out of jails, hospitals, car wrecks, when you were a walking vision of death, and that's exactly how you felt, you say in your
mm-hmm.
new book. Have you always been aware of that contradiction, you know, of the sacred and the profane running through your life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Christofferson wrote a song, and in that song was a line that says, he wrote the song about me. He's a walking contradiction, partly truth and partly fiction. And I've always explored various areas of society, and I love the young people. And I had an empathy for prisoners, and did concerts for them. Back when I thought that it would make a difference, you know, that that they really were there to be rehabilitated.
You grew up during the Depression. What are some of the things that your father did to make a living while you were a boy?
My father was a cotton farmer first, but he didn't have any land, or what land he had, he lost it in the Depression. So he worked as in the woodsman and cut pulp wood for the paper mills. Rode the rails on in boxcars, going from one harvest to another to try to make a little money picking fruit or vegetables. Did every kind of work imaginable, from painting to shoveling to herding cattle. And he's always been such an inspiration to me because of the varied kinds of things that he did and the kind of life he lived. He inspired me so that all the things he did, so far from being a soldier in World War I to being an old man in his patio sitting on the porch watching the dogs, you know, I think about his life and it would inspire me to go my own other direction. And I just like to explore minds and the desires of the people out there.
You know, it's interesting that you say your father inspired you so much. I'm sure you wouldn't have wanted to lead his life picking cotton.
I did. Until I was 18 years old, that is.
Mm-hmm.
Then I picked the guitar and I've been picking it since.
Right. Did you have a plan to get out? Did you very much want to get out of the town where you were brought up and get out of picking cotton?
Yeah, I knew that when I left there at the age of 18, I wouldn't be back.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of common knowledge among all the people there that when you graduate from high school here, you go to college or go get a job or something and do it on your own. And having been familiar with hard work, it was no problem for me. But first I hitchhiked to Pontiac, Michigan, and got a job working in Fisher Body, making those 1951 Pontiacs. I worked there 3 weeks, got really sick of it, went back home and joined the Air Force.
You have such a wonderful, deep voice. Did you start singing before your voice changed?
Oh, yeah. I got no deep voice today. I've got a cold. But when I was so young, I had a high tenor voice. I used to sing Bill Monroe songs. And I sing Dennis Day songs. Like,
oh, no.
Sang on songs that he sang on the Jack Benny show.
Wow.
Every week he sang an old Irish folk song. And next day in the fields, I'd be singing that song if I was working in the fields. And I always loved those songs, and with my high tenor, I thought I was pretty good, you know, almost as good as Dennis Day. But when I was 16, my father and I cut wood all day long, and I was swinging that crosscut saw and hauling wood. And when I walked in the back door late that afternoon, I was singing, "Everybody gonna have religion and glory, everybody gonna be singing a story." I sang those old gospel songs for my mother, and she said, "Is that you?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am." And she came over and put her arms around me and said, "God's got his hands on you." I still think of that, you know?
She realized you had a gift.
That's what she said, yeah. She called it the gift.
Well, how did you feel about your voice changing? It must have stunned you if you were singing like Dennis O'Day and then suddenly you were singing like Johnny Cash.
I don't know. I guess when I was a tenor, I just, and when it changed, I thought, well, it goes right along with these hormones, and everything's working out really good, you know. I felt like my voice was becoming a man's voice.
Right, right. So did you start singing different songs as your voice got deeper?
Mm-hmm. Lucky Old Son, Memories Are Made of This, 16 tons. I developed a pretty unusual style, I think. If I'm anything, I'm not a singer, but I'm a song stylist.
What's the difference?
Well, I say I'm not a singer, so that means I can't sing. But doesn't it?
Well, but I mean, that's not true. I understand you're making a distinction, but you certainly can sing. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. Well, song stylist is like to take an old folk song like Delia's Gone and do a modern white man's version of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A lot of those I did that way. You know, I would take songs that I'd loved as a child and redo them in my mind for the new voice I had, the low voice.
I know that you briefly took singing lessons, and you say in your new book that your singing teacher told you, you know, don't let anybody change your voice. Don't even bother with the singing lessons. How did you end up taking lessons in the first place?
My mother did that, and she was determined that I was going to leave the farm and do well in life, and she thought with the gift I might be able to do that. So she took in washing. She got a washing machine in 1942, as soon as they got electricity, and she took in washing. She washed the school teacher's clothes and anybody she could, and sent me for singing lessons for $3 per lesson, and that's how she made the money to send me.
What was your reaction when the teacher told you, don't let anybody change what you're doing, don't, you know, I'm not going to teach you anymore?
I was pretty happy about that. I didn't really want to change, you know. I felt good about my voice.
You left home when you were about 18. And then how old were you when you actually went to Memphis?
Well, I went to Memphis after I finished the Air Force in 1954.
Mm-hmm.
I lived on that farm until I went to the Air Force. I was in there four years, and when I came back, I got married and moved to Memphis. Got an apartment, started trying to sell appliances at a place called Home Equipment Company, but I couldn't sell anything and didn't really want to. All I wanted was the music, and if somebody in the house was playing music when I would come, I would stop and sing with them.
When you got to Memphis, Elvis Presley had already recorded That's All Right. Sam Phillips had produced him for his label Sun Records. You called Sam Phillips and asked for an audition. Did it take a lot of nerve to make that phone call?
No, it just took the right time. I was fully confident that I was going to see Sam Phillips and to record for him. That when I called him, I thought, I'm going to get on Sun Records. So I called him and he turned me down flat. Then 2 weeks later, I called, turned down again. He told me over the phone that he couldn't sell gospel music, so because it was independent, not a lot of money, you know. So I didn't press that issue, but one day I just decided I'm ready to go. So I went down with my guitar and sat on the front steps of his recording studio and met him when he came in. And I said, I'm John Cash. I'm the one that's been calling. And if you'd listen to me, I believe you'd be glad you did. And he said, come on in. Well, that was a good lesson for me, you know, to believe in myself.
What was the audition like?
It was about 3 hours of singing with just my guitar. Songs, a lot of them, like the songs that are in my first American Recordings album.
So what did Phillips actually respond to most of the songs that you played him?
He responded most to a song of mine called Hey Porter, which was on the first record. But he asked me to go write a love song or maybe a bitter weeper. So I wrote a song called Cry, 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 went back in and recorded that for the other side of the record.
You say in your book you had to do 35 takes of Cry, Cry, Cry. Why did it take so many takes?
It was too simple. We were trying to make something complicated out of it. It was the simplest song in the world ever written. And invariably, at some time during a take, the guitar player would mess up, or the bass player, or I would mess up, and we'd have to do it over. It's not unusual, though, to do a song 35 times.
Well, why don't we hear Cry, 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 which was on the first single that Sun Records released by you.
Okay.
Everybody knows where you go when the sun goes down. I think you only live to see the lights uptown. I wasted my time when I would try, try, try. 'Cause when the lights have lost their glow, you'll cry, cry, cry. Soon your sugar daddies will all be gone. You wake up some cold day and find you're alone. You'll call for me, but I'm gonna tell you bye, bye, bye. When I turn around and walk away, you'll cry, cry, cry. You're gonna cry, 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 and you cry alone. When everyone's forgotten and you're left on your own, you're gonna cry, cry, cry.
That's Johnny Cash. We'll hear more of our 1997 interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you.
whole train is puffing smoke, and I have to strain my eyes. But ask that engineer if he will.
Let's get back to our 1997 interview with Johnny Cash.
What was it like when you started to go on tour? You know, after coming from the cotton fields. It's true. I mean, you'd been in the Army, and you'd been abroad, you know, with the Army. But what was it like for you in the early days of getting recognized, you know, traveling around the country?
Well, when I started playing concerts, I went out from Memphis to Arkansas, Louisiana, and Tennessee, played the little towns there that I would go out myself in my car and set up the show. Or get the show booked in those theaters. And then along about 3 months later, Elvis Presley asked me to sing with him at the Overton Park Shell in Memphis. And I sang Cry, Cry, Cry and Hey Porter. And from that time on, I was on my way, and I knew it, I felt it, and I loved it. So Elvis asked me to go on tour with him, and I did. I worked with Elvis four or five tours in the next year or so. And I was always intrigued by his charisma. You know, I just, you can't be in the building without looking at him, you know? And he inspired me so that with his fire and energy that I guess that inspiration from him really helped me to go.
It's funny, I think of your charisma and his charisma as being very different forms of charisma because, I mean, he would move around so much on stage, and I think of your charisma as being a very kind of still, stoic kind of charisma.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm an old man to him. I'm 4 years older than he was. So I was 23 when I started recording, and Elvis was 19. And I was married. He wasn't. So we didn't have a lot in common family life.
Mm-hmm.
But we liked each other and appreciated each other, so he asked me to tour with him.
Did you want that kind of adulation that he was getting from girls who would come see him?
I don't remember if I wanted it, but I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did. But I didn't. I only got it to a very small degree compared to Elvis.
Right. What were the temptations like for a young married man like yourself on the road, you know, slowly becoming a star?
Fame was pretty hard to handle, actually. The country boy in me tried to break loose and take me back to the country, but the music was stronger. The urge to go out and do the gift was a lot stronger. And the temptations were women, girls, which I loved, and then amphetamines, not very much later, from running all night, you know, in our cars on tour, and the doctors got these nice pills that give us energy and keep us awake. So I started taking those, and I liked them so much I got addicted to them. And then I started taking downers or sleeping pills to come down and rest after 2 or 3 days. So it became a cycle. I was taking the pills for a while, and then the pills started taking me.
I want to play what I think was your first big hit, I Walk the Line.
Mm-hmm. That was my third record.
And you wrote the song. Tell me the story of how you wrote it and what you were thinking about at the time.
In the Air Force, I had an old Wilcox K recorder and used to hear guitar runs on that recorder going dun, 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 like the chords on I Walk the Line. And I always wanted to write a love song using that theme, you know, that tune. And so I started to write the song. And I was in Gladewater, Texas one night with Carl Perkins. And I said, I've got a good idea for a song. And I sang him the first verse that I had written. And I said, it's called Because You're Mine. And he said, I Walk the Line is a better title, so I changed it to I Walk the Line.
Now, were you thinking of your own life when you wrote this?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a prodding to myself to play it straight, Johnny.
And was this, I think I read that this was supposed to be a ballad. I mean, it was supposed to be slow when you first wrote it.
That's the way I sang it, yeah, at first. But Sam wanted it up, you know, up-tempo, and I put paper in the strings of my guitar to get that sound, and with a bass and a lead guitar, there it was, bare and stark, that song was, when it was released, and I heard it on the radio, and I really didn't like it, and I called Sam Phillips and asked him, please not send out any more records of that song.
Why?
But he laughed at me. I just didn't like the way it sounded to me. I didn't know I sounded that way, and I didn't like it. I don't know. But he said, let's give it a chance. And it was just a few days until that's all it took to take off.
That's funny. I mean, you'd heard your voice before, hadn't you?
Mm-hmm.
But so it was something in your own singing you weren't liking when you heard it?
Well, the music and my voice together, I just felt like it was really weird. But I got used to it very quickly. I don't know if that I didn't hate it, but I just didn't like it. I thought I could do better.
Johnny Cash, recorded in 1997. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds, because you're mine. I walk the line. I find it very, very easy to be true. I find myself alone when each day's through. Yes, I'll admit that I'm a fool for you.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from NPR member stations and Barnes & Noble, publishers of Anthony Trollope's satire of money madness, The Way We Live Now, in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, in stores and online. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Johnny Cash talks about June Carter Cash, and June talks about Johnny, as we hear interviews from our archive.
Well, I see you lost your honeybee, I know how. You must be feeling now. You feel sad, sad, but boy, it ain't that bad. You cry just a little bit and die just a little bit, and then you'll be all right. Well, you know.
Well, you know,
it wasn't long ago
your honeybee
was queen of my bee tree, but then away she flew and took my honey to you. You cry just a little bit and die just a little bit, and then you'll be all right.
I pity you, I know what you're going through. You watched your queen bee fly, your honeycomb went dry. But if you keep pushing on, you won't care if she's gone.
You cry just a little bit and die just a little.
This is Fresh Air, I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview I recorded in 1997 with Johnny Cash. I think it was in the late 1950s that you started doing prison concerts, which you eventually became very famous for.
Mm-hmm.
What got you started performing in prison?
Well, I had a song called Folsom Prison Blues that was a hit just before I walked the line. And the people in Texas heard about it at the state prison and got to write me letters asking me to come down there. So I responded, and then the warden called me and asked if I would come down and do a show for the prisoners in Texas. And so we went down, and there's a rodeo at all these shows that the prisoners have there. And in between the rodeo things, they asked me to set up and do two or three songs. So that was what I did. I did Folsom Prison Blues, which they thought was their song, you know. And I walked the line, ring, hey, Porter, cry, cry, cry. And then the word got around on the grapevine that Johnny Cash was all right and that you ought to see him. So the requests started coming in from other prisoners all over the United States. And then the word got around. So I always wanted to record that, you know, to record a show. Because of the reaction I got, it was far and above anything I had ever had in my life. The complete explosion of noise and reaction that they gave me with every song. Then I kept talking to my producers at Columbia about recording one of those shows. It was so exciting. I said that the people out there ought to share that, you know, and feel that excitement too. So preacher friend, a friend of mine named Floyd Gressett set it up for us. So we went into Folsom on February 11th, 1968, and recorded the show live.
Before we hear one of the tracks from that live album, tell me what it was, what kind of reaction surprised you the most when you were performing for prisoners?
Well, what really surprised me was any kind of prison song, I could do no wrong, you know, if it's whatever, the prisoner song or San Quentin, a song of mine. But they felt like they could identify with me, I suppose. I came from, I sang songs like Dark as a Dungeon or Bottom of a Mountain, songs about the working man and the hard life. And, of course, they'd been through the hard life, all of them, or they wouldn't be there. So they kind of related to all that, I guess, the songs I chose. Very little of love songs, very few. Mostly, you know, songs about the down and outer. And so then requests started coming in for me to go to other prisons, and it got overwhelming. So I decided I would do two or three, and I wouldn't do any more. Because one thing, my wife was scared to death, and the other women on the show were too. So I decided not to. It was still a great experience to get on stage and perform those people.
Why don't we hear Folsom Prison Blues from your Live at Folsom Prison record? This is Johnny Cash.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend. And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
I guess Merle Haggard was in the audience for one of your San Quentin concerts. Mm-hmm. Must have been pretty exciting to find that out. That was before he had recorded, I think, that he was in there.
Yeah, 68 and 69, right on the front row was Merle Haggard.
Yeah, and who knew?
And I didn't know that till about 1963, 62.
Uh-huh.
He told me all about it. He saw every show that I did there. And, of course, as the rest is history for Merle. He came out and immediately had success himself.
You know, it's interesting. You've always or almost always worn black during your career. Mm-hmm. And I was interested in reading that your mother hated it, too.
See, yeah. Yes, she did.
See, we have something in common. Mm-hmm. Our mothers don't like black.
Right. I love it.
Me, too. But you gave in for a while. She started making you bright, flashy outfits, even a nice white suit.
Mm-hmm.
What did it feel like for you to be on stage in bright colors or all in white?
Well, that was 1956, and I hadn't been wearing the black for very long. So it was okay. I would wear anything my mother made me, you know. I just couldn't afford to turn her down. But before long, I decided to start with the black and stick with it because it felt good to me on stage that a figure there in black and everything coming out of his face, that's the way I wanted to do it.
We're listening back to a 1997 interview with Johnny Cash. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Before we get back to our 1997 interview with Johnny Cash, let's hear a recording that he made with the Carter family in 1964, about 4 years before he married June Carter. This track features Cash, June Carter, her sisters Anita and Helen, and their mother, Maybelle.
There's a dark and troubled side of life. There's a bright and a sunny side.
Storm in its fury broke today, crushing hopes that I cherish so dear. Storms and clouds will in time pass away, and the sun again will shine bright and clear.
Keep on sunny side.
You married your second wife, your wife June Carter, now June Carter Cash, in 1968. How did you first meet the members of the Carter family, the kind of first family of country music?
I met June at the backstage at the Grand Ole Opry when I did my first appearance as a guest artist. And it was 5 years again, till 5 years more till I saw her again. And we started working together, touring, beginning in Des Moines in January 1962. And we've been together ever since. I met her family when about my second tour that we had June on, because I asked them to all come and be a part of the show. So I kind of got into those people and became one of their family, and it felt good to go out with them.
What was it like traveling with a family instead of being on your own? Being on your own, leaving the family behind?
I really don't like to do an appearance without June Carter. And what it would be like being alone, it would be awfully lonely to me. I'm very comfortable with, you know, how we do it, my wife and my son on the show and a daughter or two. And it feels so good. I would hate to think that I had to do it all alone.
Did it change your life to have a family that really understood the performing life because it was their life too?
Very much so, yeah, right.
What was the difference? I mean, why was that so important?
Well, there's something about families singing together that is just better than any other groups you can pick up or make, you know. If it's family, if it's blood on blood, then it's going to be better. The voices singing their parts are going to be tighter, and they're going to be more on pitch because it's, as I say, it's a bloodline on bloodline.
A few years ago, you started making records with Rick Rubin. Tell me how you and he first met up. It seemed initially like a very improbable match. He had produced a lot of rap records and produced the Beastie Boys and the Red Hot Chili Peppers. You know, it would seem like a surprising match. It ended up being a fantastic match. How did he approach you?
Well, my contract with Mercury Polygram Nashville was about to expire. And I never had really been happy. The company, the record company, just didn't put any promotion behind me. I think one album, maybe the last one I did, they pressed 500 copies. And I was just disgusted with it. So I decided I'll just do my thing. I'll do my tours and writing, and that's all I need. So that's what I was trying to do. But I got hungry to be back in the studio, to be creative and put something down, you know, for the fans to hear. And about that time that I got to feeling that way, Lou Robin, my manager, came to me and talked to me about a man called Rick Rubin that he had been talking to that wanted me to sign with his record company. It was American Recordings. I said, I like the name, maybe it'd be okay. So I said, I'd like to meet the guy. I'd like for him to tell me what he can do with me that they're not doing now. So he came to my concert in Orange County, California. I believe this was like 83 when he first came. And listened to the show, and then afterwards I went in the dressing room and sat and talked to him. And you know, he had his hair, I don't think it's ever been cut. And very, dresses like a hobo, usually, clean, but which kind of guy I really felt comfortable with, actually. I think I was more comfortable with him than I would have been with a producer with a suit on. Well, I said, what are you going to do with me that nobody else has been able to do to sell records with me? And he said, well, I don't know that we will sell records. He said, I would like you to go with me and sit in my living room with a guitar and two microphones and just sing to your heart's content everything you ever wanted to record. I said, that sounds good to me. So I did that, and day after day, 3 weeks, I sang for him. And when I finally stopped, he had been saying, like the last day or so, he'd been saying, now, I think we should put this one in the album. So without him saying, I want to record you and release an album, he started saying, let's put this one in the album. So the album, this big question, you know, began to take form, take shape. And Rick and I would weed out the songs. There were songs that didn't feel good to us that we would say, let's don't consider that one. And then we'd focus on the ones that we did like, that felt right and sounded right. And if I didn't like the performance on that song, I would keep trying it and do take after take until it felt comfortable with me and felt that it was coming out of me and my guitar and my voice as one, that it was right from my soul. That's how I felt about it. All those things in that first album. And I got really excited about it. But then we went into the studio and tried to record some with different musicians, and it didn't sound good. It didn't work. So we put together the album with just a guitar and myself.
Yeah, I was really glad you did it that way. There's something just so naked about it. There's something so just emotionally naked. And there's so much emotion in your voice, and it just all comes across really clearly.
Thank you.
I think these records and the touring that you've done with them has helped introduce you to a younger audience that wasn't around during your earlier hits and maybe knew your reputation but didn't really know your music very well. And I'm wondering what that experience has been like for you to play to younger audiences who are first getting acquainted with your music.
Oh, it feels like 1955 all over again. It really does. It really does. And the ones who have been into my new recordings are becoming familiar with some of the old stuff, like Folsom and I Walk the Line and Ring of Fire. And those songs now just really get a reaction like I did on my songs back in the 50s. But it feels so good with those young people and the adulation. I just love it. I've always been a big ham. I just eat it up. No, I'm very appreciative to them.
Johnny Cash, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
I want to say you're really good at what you do, and I appreciate you. Thank you.
Johnny Cash, recorded in 1997. He died in 2003 at the age of 71. Here's a track from the first of the Johnny Cash albums produced by Rick Rubin. The song is by Leonard Cohen.
Like a bird on a wire, like a drunk in a midnight choir, I have tried in my way to be free. Like a fish on a hook, like a night in some old-fashioned book. I have saved all my ribbons for thee. And if I have been unkind, I just hope you will let it go by.
Rick Rubin will talk about Johnny Cash on tomorrow's Fresh Air. Coming up, an interview with June Carter Cash. This is Fresh Air. We're spending Thanksgiving listening back to interviews with Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash. June joined Johnny's Roadshow in 1962, co-wrote his 1963 hit Ring of Fire, married him in 1968, and toured with him until he stopped performing in the late 90s. But she got her start in show business long before she met him. She was born into what many consider the first family of country music. Her mother was Maybelle Carter of the original Carter family. After that group broke up, Maybelle Carter formed a new group with her daughters Helen, Anita, and June. Here's one of June's last recordings. It was made in 1999, 4 years before her death. The song was written by her uncle, A.P. Carter.
I was standing by my window on one cold and cloudy day when I saw that hearse come rolling for to carry my mother away. Will a circle be unbroken by and by, Lord, by and by? There's better home awaiting in the sky, Lord, in the sky.
In 1987, I asked June Carter Cash about the beginning of her career.
I was about 10 years old. About 10, I think. And I really didn't know if I was going to be able to perform or not. I had two sisters who could perform, and when you're standing there and you're used to just running and catching light bugs and June bugs and riding the motorcycle behind your daddy and being a tomboy, you don't know if you can sing or not.
Did you want to perform?
Oh, I hadn't even thought about it. I didn't think I could. But then mother said, you know, you're going to sing, or at least I guess you are, and you're also going to learn to play that auto harp and that mandolin and that guitar and whatever. So within about a week's time, I learned to sing. I had to. But believe me, Terry, I was up and down that scale because I really didn't know where I was going to begin with.
It sounds like you didn't have a lot of confidence in your singing.
I really didn't, but I had a lot of guts. I really didn't mind trying anything, and I think that's one reason in the beginning that I used to do comedy in the beginning. I just did it because I didn't think I could sing as good as my sisters.
What were the best shows, your favorite shows to do?
Well, I've had a lot of different shows in my life. The Days with the Carter Family, that was a wonderful kind of thing. I can remember doing shows from the days in the old coal fields where there was no electricity at all, and they put the lamps on the front of the stage. I went from that to having our first public address system, doing the little concerts around in schoolhouses, and then in larger auditoriums when the Carter Family was around.
When you were young, were you aware of how important your mother was in country music?
I really had no idea. I honest to goodness thought everybody alive had a sweet little blue-eyed mother that picked the wildwood flower on the guitar. But Terry, the one thing that reminded me when my mother did pass away was the television cameras that came from all of the major networks, and then I began to know. And, of course, if there's the times that you ever read the history books in country music, she had a strong influence on our music. And, of course, my Uncle A.P. Carter and the songs of the Carter Family. That's kind of a basis for our country music today.
It's interesting to me that you grew up into a life of country music and you were singing it and playing it when you were very young. But when you came of age, you left that life for a while to go to Manhattan. What made you want to try out a different life for a while, to try to get into movies, for instance, to move up north, to move to the city?
Well, you see, I had married the top country music entertainer, a man named Carl Smith. He was our number one country artist for 3 years during the time we were married. And we had a little girl, and my marriage had gone crazy, and I was heartbroken. And I just took off and brought Carlene, and I had what I thought was a tiny little apartment. I had 5 rooms, and I lived at 20 East 67th between Madison and 5th, and I thought, this is not big enough to cook any kind of a breakfast in. How am I going to get the gravy and the biscuits made here? It's not big enough. I thought I was cooking in a closet.
Did you experience culture shock in Manhattan?
Oh, my goodness. Let me tell you, I'm a little mountain girl. I mean, even though I've been in radio and been lots of places, I've traveled, but I had myself quite a shock. I'd been here before. My mother and sisters and I had performed 4 times on the Kate Smith Evening Hour when she had her first hour-long show. And we were performing live with Kate in front of about 5,000 people. But I was a very young girl at that time, and I didn't let too much in New York get on me. But when I came here to go to school, listen, I had to learn the hard way.
Why did you leave Manhattan?
Well, in country music, I was established. I could make a lot of money. I could make a whole lot more money in country music than I could in this area, but I was working the fair seasons. I was going out to California and doing some acting because I'd done things like Gunsmoke and some series that I'd worked in, and I was working some with Tennessee Ernie Ford on television. So I went back to Nashville and the Grand Ole Opry because of some long extended tours that I had that was paying me quite a bit of money. Then, to make a long story short, I ended up with Johnny Cash came into my life, and I ended up being Mrs. Johnny Cash, and I'll never regret that.
When you realized that you were both in love, were you ever afraid to marry him because of his chemical dependency?
Oh, of course, of course. I only decided 6 months before we were married. I made my mind up, okay, if you feel that you can stay straight, I will marry you. If that's what you really think that you can do. And he stayed straight for 6 months. I handed in my resignation to the Grand Ole Opry, and I thought, if you die, I will stand near you while you die. If you live, I will live with you, and I will be with you. I will help you whatever you do. But it was a total commitment that I made at that point. And he never let me down.
In your new book, you've written about women friends and women in your family who were abused by their husbands or who had to put up with drug and alcohol problems that their husbands had. How much power do you think a loving wife has to change her husband if he has a problem either with violence or with drugs or alcohol?
Well, you have much more power if you're a praying woman than you could believe. I prayed continually, and I lifted up all my problems to God. If you have a person who is a chemically dependent person in your family, child or husband, whatever the situation would be, if you pray hard, believing that God can help you, and you just lift that up, I am living proof that it can work.
You wrote the song Ring of Fire, which Johnny Cash recorded, had a big hit with it. Did you write that song with him in mind?
Yes, I did. You know, he didn't even know, but I think I'd come to grips with the fact that I was in love with this man. He was still at that time with his wife. I was still married at the time. I think that's what the song was about. Because, I mean, I couldn't tell anybody. How could I tell anybody? Because it was like a ring of fire.
When you gave the song to Johnny Cash to record, did he know that it was about him?
I don't know. My sister recorded it first, Anita, and it was more like the Carter family might have done it, because we were primarily more folk music. And so then Anita and Helen and Mother and I sung it with John, and we put the trumpets on it, and it became a big, big song. It's been recorded over 100 times.
June Carter Cash, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
June Carter Cash, recorded in 1987. She died in 2003. Tomorrow, we'll hear more about Johnny Cash and his music. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer and director is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a happy Thanksgiving.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring, bound by wild desire. I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire. The ring of fire.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. And from the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support, on the web at kresge.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Delia, oh Delia, Delia all my life.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about and listen to Johnny Cash's final recordings with his producer, Rick Rubin. And we hear from Cash's daughter, Roseanne Cash. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
I went up to Memphis and I met Delia there.